both important and both necessary. In fact, he uses them interchangeably. If you go back to chapter 1, look at verse 8 of chapter 1. He just said in chapter 16 that their obedience is known to all. Look at chapter 1, verse 8. First, I thank my God through Jesus Christ for all of you, because your faith is known throughout the whole world. Now, which is it? Is it their faith or their obedience that's proclaimed? Well, I think he's using them interchangeably. They have the obedience of faith. Because they believe, they obey. So I think that's super, super helpful, because Paul is going to make a lot of nuanced and powerful statements about faith and about obedience. And knowing how he thinks about faith and obedience is going to be really helpful to understanding those passages. So if you just take Romans out of context and you look at chapter 3 and 4 by themselves, somebody could make the argument that you only need to intellectually acknowledge that Christ died. But then somebody could take Romans 6 and Romans 8 and say you need to obey, and by your obedience you earn your salvation. They're a bunch of chapters from the same book. You've got to look at it as a whole and look at how Paul understands it. The same person who wrote the very powerful statements in chapter 4 also wrote chapter 8. That's why it's important for us to see that they both go together. You're probably wondering, Matt, this is boring. Why are you harping on this? I'm harping on it so that you guys don't get crazy ideas later. That's why. Because I've had these crazy ideas before. And it's important that we establish that faith and obedience go hand in hand. We see Paul starting and ending Romans, establishing that fact. And when we understand that, we can look at these very powerful and maybe scary passages and feel safe, because we know that we're not going to go too far. Paul has already laid the boundaries for us about where these concepts lie. Okay. Let's continue on in chapter 1. Look at chapter 1, 8 through 15. I'll read it again. First, I thank my God through Jesus Christ for all of you, because your faith is proclaimed in all the world. For God is my witness, whom I serve with my spirit in the gospel of his Son, that without ceasing I mention you, always in my prayers, asking that somehow by God's will I may at last succeed in coming to you. For I long to see you, that I may impart to you some spiritual gift to strengthen you. That is, that we may be mutually encouraged by each other's faith, both yours and mine. I do not want you to be unaware, brothers, that I have often intended to come to you, but I have thus far been prevented, in order that I may reap some harvest among you, as well as among the rest of the Gentiles. For I am under obligation to both Greeks and to barbarians, both to the wise and to the foolish. So I'm eager to preach the gospel to you also who are in Rome. So this is kind of Paul's second introduction. He gives his mission statement in 1 through 7. Verses 8 through 15, he gets a lot more personal. He starts using a lot easier to digest phrases and words and a lot less run-on sentences. First of all, he's thankful for these Christians. We look in verse 13 that he's never met them. This is not a church that he's very familiar with, but this is a church he loves and he respects a lot. I think that's powerful. I really appreciate how a lot of the brothers and sisters here go through a big effort to continue to remind everyone about how much we love each other. That's very good. But you know, Paul was so good about that, he did that for people he never even worshiped with yet. That's really good. And not only does Paul constantly think about them, think fondly of them, he's often praying for them. In verse 10, he says, always in my prayers, asking God that somehow by God's will, I may at last succeed in coming to you. How often do you pray for people in other churches? I'm sure a lot of you do, but how often do you do that? And how often do you pray about people you never met? I think that's a really good way to show we're different from those in the world. There's a lot of people in the United States who still go to church, who are still religious. Yeah, that number's going down. But especially in this area here, most people still go to some sort of religious organization. But they don't pray for their other associates, I guess, in other places. They don't often do that. Their church is their church. I remember my parents were asking about my prayer list once, about why I prayed for people who I never worshiped with. They thought that was absurd. Like, in their minds, you have your church, and that's your church. Anybody else, that's not your problem. But that's not how God makes the church work in the New Testament. We're all a family, regardless if we all worship within the same walls. And Paul is a great example of that. He loves everyone. Something else that I think is very powerful is his desire to see them and his reason for seeing them. In verses 11 and 12, it's easy to understand why you might think the spiritual gift he's talking about is the laying on of hands and the ability to speak in tongues. But he clarifies that. Look at verse 11 and 12. He says, "For I long to see you, that I may impart some spiritual gift to strengthen you. That is, that we may be encouraged by each other's faith, both yours and mine." And if you're reading the ESV, at the end of verse 11, there's a dash there, indicating the thought is being continued. In fact, if I understand correctly, every major translation has either an apostrophe, a colon, something to indicate that the thought is being continued between verse 11 and verse 12. Paul is being specific. The spiritual gift that he's been praying to God about, laboring in prayer, is that he just wants to be encouraged. Not only does he want to be encouraged, he wants to encourage them. And in verse 12, what does he want to encourage them with? And what does he want to be encouraged by? Each other's faith. There's a couple things I just want to mention about that. First of all, is that the fact that Paul the Apostle was actively seeking encouragement, that just humbles me, right? I think a lot of us think that we're so strong and we're so wise and that we don't need anybody else to remain strong in Christ. Look, I'll tell you this. If Paul the Apostle needed encouragement and sought it out from other people, we'd need it too. Like, he got to speak to Christ face to face. There's nobody here who has that privilege. Yet he still sought encouragement from other Christians. And when he was laboring in prayer to go see the Romans, at least what he reveals for us here, that's what he was thinking of. Do we seek that out from our brethren? Seriously, do we seek that out? I think we sometimes fail at being willing to confess our sins because we're also failing at being willing to confess our faith to each other. And here's what I mean by that. You might think that's odd, but here's the thing. Just imagine how awesome it would be to just sit in a room and listen to Paul say from his own lips all the adventures, all the trials, all the tribulations he suffered for Christ. And listen to his thought process about how Christ had encouraged him, about how Christ had given him hope. That'd be really encouraging to have the opportunity to pick his brain and learn about his faith. Just think about how awesome that would be. And you know what else that would do? That'd help you feel close to him. That'd help you trust him. Have you ever had that experience with somebody else? Maybe it's a new Christian. I'll tell you what. Craig's been announcing that Paula needs more rides to church. If you want to experience verses 11 and 12, give Paula a ride. Man, listening to her story, going from getting kicked out of the Catholic Church because she's teaching the Bible, then being kind of like in an awkward position at the Mormon church because she keeps on asking for just reading the Bible, and then finally reading the Bible with Tammy and realizing that that's the truth and all the sacrifices she had to make You know, when you hear her struggles, hear her faith, hear her willingness to sacrifice, that just gets you really fired up. I have a hard time not wanting to work even harder after having a conversation with her. But I think sometimes we're so afraid of bragging, which is fair, we should not be braggarts, but we're so afraid of bragging, we're just so impersonal, we kind of lock ourselves up, and we don't share about the things that God has done to encourage us. But we're really doing wrong to each other when we do that. Imagine if when I got up here and I preached, I wasn't happy. I never shared the things that I thought were awesome from God. I just kept it even more boring than what I already am. That wouldn't be good. We need to be willing to share the wonderful things that God has done for us. Because not only is that good for other people, it's good for us. I think, and once again, if we could learn to grow and trust each other, where Dan shared with me all the hard things that he had to do to serve God, and I did that for him, if we can rejoice in each other's victory, if we can find that type of person, that means we can find somebody who will be there when we fall. We need to seek that out. It's not bragging to talk about how much God has helped you. In fact, it's kind of doing the opposite. You're admitting how much help you need. It's okay to glorify God. I also just appreciate verse 13. I could be wrong, but I don't think the Romans were dying to hear an answer about why Paul hasn't seen them. But he loves them so much, he went out of his way to reassure them. He made clear to them, "I have often intended to come to you, but have thus far been prevented, in order that I might reap some harvest among you, as well as among the rest of the Gentiles." Now, once again, that sounds really pretty, really beautiful, but think about it. What harvest, besides what we just spoke about, the mutual encouragement, what harvest is Paul going to reap from people who are already Christians? I think sometimes we think the gospel is only needed for those who are outside of Christ. That's not the vibe I'm getting from Paul right now. He said over and over again about how much he wants to preach the gospel to them. He's made it clear in verse 7 his audiences are entirely Christians, but he still feels an obligation to teach them. Once again, I think we do ourselves a disservice when we think we are too old, too seasoned, too mature to hear the gospel over again. I think we're lying to ourselves, and we're really just missing out. Paul didn't think these people were too mature to hear the gospel. I mean, these are people who Paul actually was looking forward to see. He doesn't write that to the Galatians for a reason. They stressed him out. They didn't encourage him, right? He doesn't even really say that in 1 Corinthians either. He wants to see them, but not so he can be built up, so he can set things straight, right? This is a good group. He praises them for their faith and obedience being spread everywhere. But even they still needed to hear the gospel. Once again, same for us. We are never too mature in Christ to hear the gospel again. And this isn't just Paul telling them to do it because they need it. He has the obligation to do so. Verses 14 and 15. "I am under obligation to both Greeks and to barbarians, both to the wise and to the foolish. So I'm eager to speak, to preach the gospel to you also who are in Rome." We have the obligation to constantly teach each other, even teach those who are mature. I think we're going to spend the rest of the evening discussing verses 16 and 17. Romans 1, 16 and 17. Paul says, "For I'm not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. For in it the righteousness of God is revealed from faith for faith. As it is written, the righteous shall live by faith." You know, the reason why I like verse 16 is because Paul doesn't have to write it. It's obvious by the life Paul lived. He was not ashamed of the gospel. But obviously, he's not writing just to talk about himself. He's setting an example for the reader. And it's a very important example because the gospel is going to be something that's powerful, that changes your life. It's going to be hard for you, and it's going to be even harder for others to accept. And he's getting them inoculated. This is going to be difficult, but do not be ashamed of it. He's writing to a church that does have quite a bit of Jews, but is largely Gentiles, and he's getting them ready. Your neighbors aren't going to like what you're teaching. It's going to be hard enough for you to do it, but your neighbors are going to make it even harder. Do not be ashamed. And he says why? It is the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes, to the Jew first, and also to the Greek. I heard a really interesting illustration by Gary Fisher once, and I'm probably going to butcher it, but I think it was very helpful. The gospel is going to make us seem like aliens to the people around us. And that's not new. Yeah, our culture's changing. But there's always going to be things about the gospel that's going to be different from the world. But that's not something to be ashamed of. I think it's important to understand we are going to be different. I mean, that's why Paul even brings up not being ashamed, right? It's something that's going to be expected. But we are going to be different. Imagine if you lived during the Middle Ages, you were just some peasant rolling mud, but then some king came and he adopted you. And he brought you into his family, he got you educated, you learned to dress like the king, talk like the king, and you get a bath for the first time, you don't stink anymore. You know, when you go back home to visit your peasant brethren, they're probably going to make fun of you. You dress funny, you talk funny, and you don't smell funny when you should smell funny. They're going to try to nitpick at everywhere you're different. Now, you're not different because you're better. You only have those privileges because you got adopted by a gracious and loving king. And the inheritance you have is not something you earn or you deserve. It was given as a gift. But your adopted father expects you to live no longer like the people rolling around in the mud, making mud pies. You're now to live a holy life and live like royalty. And it's the same way for us. We are adopted by the creator of the universe. Our inheritance is not something we earned, not something we deserve, but it's something given to us by a gracious and loving king. And should the educated, adopted prince feel stupid just because he dresses different? No, he's blessed. Yeah, the way that he lives now is not something to be ashamed of, but something to be grateful for. We shouldn't be ashamed for the way we're living. Verse 17, Paul says, "For in it the righteousness of God is revealed from faith for faith, as it is written, the righteous shall live by faith." I gave an invitation from Habakkuk. And let's go there. I know a lot of you were here, but I don't think it'd be fair to the text if we didn't address it. And I think, really, when you look at Habakkuk, it highlights why people might try to make us feel ashamed. Habakkuk chapter 2... For the context, Habakkuk has brought two complaints to God. Habakkuk's first complaint was about Israel, and God's answer was he's going to send the Babylonians. And then Habakkuk's second complaint was about the Babylonians. And so now God's going to answer his second complaint. I want to start off with chapter 2, verse 1, because I appreciate his attitude. Habakkuk says in chapter 2, verse 1, "I will take my stand at my watchpost and station myself on the tower and look out to see what he will say to me and what I will answer concerning my complaint. And the Lord said to me, 'Write the vision, make it plain on the tablets, so he may run who reads it. For still the vision awaits its appointed time. It hastens to the end. It will not lie. If it seems slow, wait for it. It will surely come. It will not delay. Behold, his soul is puffed up. It is not upright within him. but the righteous shall live by faith. God tells Habakkuk that this coming judgment of the Babylonians, you need to write down so that the person who reads it may run. And he lets him know, this vision is coming. Verse 2, it awaits its appointed time. If it seems slow, wait for it. It will surely come. It will not delay. God's warning Habakkuk of this coming judgment and gets him ready and prepared, not just for his own self, but to write down the message so all those who read, they themselves can flee. And then he talks about the person with the puffed up soul in verse 4 and compares it to the person of faith. Behold, his soul is puffed up within him. His soul is puffed up. It is not upright within him. But the righteous shall live by faith. Now, there's a debate about who this puffed up person is. But for the sake of our purposes here, I'm going to take it as the person who is too proud to obey the message. So we have two options. We can listen to the words of the prophets, and we can run when danger comes, or we can be intimidated by the people who don't believe. And there's going to be people who don't believe. I'm sure Habakkuk might have been called a fool, going around telling his brethren that Babylon's going to come, Babylon's going to destroy Jerusalem, Babylon's going to take you away to captivity. You think everybody was comforting and congratulatory to Habakkuk for all his good preaching? No. The prophets always had it hard. Now, the person who listens and hears that message, should they be ashamed? If the entire city laughs and mocks at Habakkuk, guess what? The person who hears Habakkuk and runs, they're going to live. Yeah, they may look like a fool running out of the city, but they're going to be the one to keep their lives and not go to Babylon in captivity. The same concept applies to us. The righteous shall live by his faith, even if it makes the righteous look stupid. The fact of the matter is, it doesn't matter what it looks like to the world. God's gospel is not something to be ashamed of. And see, here's the thing about the power of God. It's not necessarily something that is always seen. If you look at chapter 1, verses 19 and 20, Paul addresses that about God's power. He says, what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them. For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, has been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world, and the things that have been made, so they are without excuse. Paul says God's eternal power and divine nature have been clearly perceived. Well, how many of you have seen God create the whole world? None of us. There's nobody here thousands of years old. The way God's power works is not a way that's obvious and is easily perceived. So it's not like we can just go around when we're saved and blast people with God's power. No. It's something, just like we look at creation and we see his power manifest over time, it's the same way for Christians. In fact, the thing that they are shaming us for is the thing that is demonstrating God's power, his change in our life. Last but not least, in verse 17, that statement that he quotes from Habakkuk, the righteous shall live by faith. Now, there's some debate about what does Paul mean there? Does he mean that you shall live because you have faith? Or is he saying you will live by your faith? I think he means both things. I don't see anything within any of his writing to limit it one way or the other. Just like in Habakkuk, you lived if you had faith in the prophet and you ran. Also in Habakkuk, if you lived by your faith, you'd run. It's the same thing. You're just putting one before the other. And once again, I think that's helpful. If we want to live, we need to have faith. Also, we need to live our life by our faith. Paul is going to establish both things in the book of Romans. That brings us to our time for tonight. That's all I wanted to go through. Thank you, everybody, for listening. So that's the gospel. We talked about it's through Christ. We didn't talk about what he did. He died on the cross, if you didn't know that. Jesus Christ, 2,000 years ago, died on the cross by the hands of Pontius Pilate. And 3 days later, he was raised from the dead. And this faith Paul is talking about is faith in him, faith in Jesus Christ, trusting in him, obeying him, and joining him in baptism. If there's anybody here who hasn't done that, who needs to do that, who has questions about how to do that, please come forward as we sing the song of invitation.